But are they going to stop the war on poverty? No, no. Ultra trillions have been spent trying to eliminate poverty, and it's just as bad as ever. Okay, war on drugs. You want a war on drugs. Oh, how's that going? Drugs are winning. I've got a cartoon here, a political cartoon from Sunday's paper. One of the best I've seen. I need to give it the Reynolds Award. What it shows is a blank map of the United States with, in big letters, demand. And above the United States is two reasons the arrest of El Chapo Guzman won't significantly disrupt the drug trade. And what do we got there? Where's the supply? Come from Mexico, right? This Guzman was a drug warlord, cartelist. And yeah, why do you have all this supply coming into the U.S. from Mexico into America? Because of enormous demand for recreational drugs. So guess what? You got all the same side effects and principal effects of the war called on prohibition, the war on alcohol that the federal government was involved in for so long and lost and quit, finally gave up to an extent at least. And then you've got all like the Bush and Clinton crime families involved in the drug trade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so next item. This leads into our discussion of 9/11. And that the fraud that it is. Remember how Bush supposedly, the President Bush, supposedly wrote in his diary that night of 9/11 that this was the new Pearl Harbor. Okay, let's check out what happened in the original Pearl Harbor. And we need to discuss this a little bit to open up some minds so that they could think based on some facts. So we need to get people to consider the evidence. You know, how do they won't even consider it. Why? Well, our government leaders would never murder 3,000 Americans. Oh, no. Oh, no, no. They wouldn't do something so psychotic, sociopathic, and so murderous. Oh, no, they'd never do that. Well, let's check out the original Pearl Harbor. And then someone would squeal if we had this many people involved in such a large operation of mass murder on U.S. soil. Someone would squeal. Well, did they squeal in the original Pearl Harbor scam? No, they didn't. And there were hundreds who knew better. All right, well, let's check into the original Pearl Harbor. That was a complete setup. The United States government under Franklin Delano Roosevelt lured, provoked Japan into the attack at Pearl Harbor. Now, this is proven by all the facts. The main thing you can consult is Robert Stinnett's book, Day of Deceit. He spent 17 years on that book that was published in 2001, 200,000 documents. And what did he find? Well, not only had the United States government cracked the Japanese diplomatic codes, so we knew what all they were discussing in supposed secret, but we also had their naval code. So while they were steaming across the Western Pacific, they didn't even maintain radio silence either. We knew everything in Washington they did, but they kept husband Kimmel, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, and Walter Short, his U.S. Army equivalent, in the dark. They denied intelligence. It was a complete setup. I hear a transition underway, and let's join the U.S. Marines, who've seen a lot of action. War is good or bad. Is there a good war? Oh, military music. In a way, it's uplifting. It's better than the anti-war music, unfortunately, is my comment. Well, here we are in the Reynolds Reveal, and my name is Morgan Reynolds, and I welcome you back. And if you would like to call in, the Guerrilla Media Network welcomes that. The number is 218-862-9829. And I'd like to welcome our special guest today aboard. And first, we have John Lear, who is he's a kind of a famous pilot for a retired pilot. And the son, yes, he is related. He's the son of Bill Lear, the co-founder of Motorola. And I think we have him to thank he should have a lot of the credit for putting radios, solving the engineering problems of radios in automobiles. And, of course, he founded the Lear jet, or invented that. And John Lear, my guest today, at one time held 17 aircraft speed records, including the fastest time around the world in a Lear jet. And finally, John is maybe not famous, but I want to thank him for submitting an affidavit in my federal case against the NIST subcontractors and in the plane fraud back in 2007. Welcome, John Lear.
Thank you, Morgan. And it was so easy to do that affidavit because it was so easy to knock down the supposed evidence.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's, you know, that's our main task today. And we also are joined by Andrew Johnson over there in the UK. And I'm giving him different labels of high praise, but he's the voice of reason from the UK, and his website is checktheevidence.com. Welcome, Andrew Johnson.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, Morgan, in such esteemed company.
Yes. Well, we've got a pretty good trio. I think we should acknowledge the truth of that statement. Now, I want to kick this off on the other side of the break. I mentioned that 9/11 was termed the new Pearl Harbor. And, well, let's look at the original Pearl Harbor and mention the whole. It came out in 2000. Robert Stinnett is called the Day of Evidence, and what he does is prove by enormous evidence that the Clinton regime had to seduce and Japan into attacking at Pearl Harbor.
Dr. Reynolds, this is Pete Santilli. I'm sorry to interrupt your flow, but your transmission was very choppy. You may want to repeat that last sentence, and I'll cut this part out.
Okay. The Roosevelt administration seduced and provoked the Japanese government into attacking America at Pearl Harbor. So in other words, Roosevelt, George C. Marshall on down were traitors to the Constitution and the American people. And I'll mention a couple of facts. Roosevelt was an expert on the Navy. He was Secretary of Navy prior to and during World War I. And he part of his plan, he had an 8 drawn up by Commander Arthur McCollum of the Navy, 8-point plan to get Japan to strike the first blow. And it included cutting off Japan from oil imports, seizing their assets in the U.S., and the bait. And Roosevelt ordered the Pacific commander, James O. Richardson, to take the Pacific fleet from San Diego and move it out to the Hawaiian Islands, to Pearl Harbor, where it was a sitting duck. And Richardson, who was a sterling character, much admired, refused to move the fleet to as bait out there. And he was replaced by husband Kimmel, and Walter Short was the army commander at Pearl. And they were denied intelligence. And I went to a book introduction near my house here in Arkansas by a guy named Jerry J. Carroll. He has a book, a novel called The Big Liars, that puts this out in the public, which is, I think, is a very good idea. People read fiction more often than non. So he's basically put the guy in the White House. And the first, after his presentation, the first question was, well, if you were going to set this up, but why didn't you warn the commanders out there so they could take defensive measures? And Carroll answered quite legitimately, well, you don't want a pinprick. He wanted real damage. In other words, we want this causus belli. And doesn't this give us some insight into 9/11 here? And I want my guest to respond. If nothing else, the original Pearl Harbor that shows our leadership is sociopathic enough to set up a situation where 3,000 of their countrymen are murdered. And then in Pearl Harbor, while hundreds were in on it, much admired people like George C. Marshall, they were in on it. Well, what about them? Did anybody ever rat it out? Nobody ever did. And they even had 9 investigations of the Pearl Harbor debacle. And of course, they were all, that's meant to cover up, essentially. So this audio, I hope some people will look at 9/11 with some objectivity. What about that idea, Andrew?
Well, I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of history behind Pearl Harbor. I don't know much of it. I've only come across it since I started studying 9/11. But it seems clear from the stuff that I've come across that it's just another instance of, you know, setting things up politically to get people to sympathize with acts of war, which, of course, is exactly what happened with 9/11, although the war is, you know, different and everything. But it's basically the same thing.
John, what do you have to say about the original Pearl Harbor as another example of treason?
Yeah, I agree with you. I really didn't know that George C. Marshall was so involved, but that makes sense.
Yeah, he was Army Chief of Staff. You know, I mean, and these guys are, I could quote chapter and verse. There's an article on my website by Alan Stang that quotes generously or cites generously from Stinnett and makes this argument. And that is that the original Pearl Harbor shows two lessons for 9/11. One, our leaders, they had a precedent here. Our leaders clearly conspired to arrange this attack. And two, there wasn't anybody ratting it out. So kind of the arguments, the most common arguments that people will pull are thereby not valid because we've got historical precedent. They always say, these leaders would never do that, attack our own people. And then the second argument is, exactly. There's so many people, they would have ratted it out, like anybody would have listened anyway if they had. Well, let's go to 9/11 then. Most people are cynical enough to know that government lies, and they lie big on some issues. And that's why I would argue we need to consider everything about 9/11. It is a big lie. Maybe most evidently because of physical impossibilities, and we'll get into some of those. But it's also, we need to consider the airplane stories. And why is that so important? Because of what Webster Tarpley calls the blood libel. They need the story that there were Arab hijackers, and therefore it's a foreign attack by foreign terrorists, as a pretext for war. In the, I would say, and they openly, the neoconservatives openly preach this, in the pursuit of world hegemony, which means authority over the entire globe, no matter how absurd that is. It's the pursuit of the new world order of a particular breed. So let me get your thoughts on that argument. To me, this is why no planes is very critical. To me, it's the best established, well, one of the two best established conclusions about 9/11. One is there weren't any plane crashes, airliner plane crashes. Number two, The World Trade Center was destroyed by an exotic weapon called directed energy weapon. Those are just, and they are not popular conclusions in the 9/11 truth movement. John, what's your response?
Absolutely, that makes sense, the whole thing, and you just wonder where now Pearl Harbor. How did those guys justify what they did? Did they have something that happened before that they could draw upon, or did they just figure, well, we'll probably get away with it?
Well, you know, history is this stream of things, and the way to understand World War II is that World War I was unfinished business. Remember, the Treaty of Versailles imposed all these sanctions on Germany. And Germany hadn't been defeated in the field, and there was resentment. A lot of observers at the time said, there's going to be another giant conflict here. Because of the injustices to Germany, we went back on our promises, the Allies, to get Germany to surrender, et cetera. And then, of course, Churchill was the secretary. He was the Lord of the Admiralty. He and FDR had connived to sink the Lusitania, which was a British warship. And Britain, get Andrew's comment about this. Britain had long, the British government had long sought to contain Germany from becoming the dominant power. That didn't mean Germany is going to be the dominant power on the continent. And Churchill wanted the U.S. to come in on the side of the Allies in World War II, of course. Remember, the war was going for over 2 years before the U.S. got involved. And Hitler was very careful to avoid antagonizing the U.S., even though the U.S. was doing all these things to aid the British effort, okay? So there's all kinds of plotting going on here to make it happen. And then, you know, one of the amusing parts of this was Hitler actually, within 3 days of the Pearl Harbor attack, the U.S. declares war on Germany. Within 3 days, Hitler declared war on the United States based in part on a false letter that FDR was going to declare war unilaterally without the Congress. With a fake letter planted there by Intrepid. Intrepid was the model for James Bond, 007. You know what I mean? So Andrew might have some insight into my sermonette there about World War II.
Well, I mean, I'm not really much of a World War II historian, to be honest. I mean, you know, we've heard lots about it here, but this, you know, I think a lot of it is propaganda. And particularly in the case of a figure like Churchill, who was, you know, at the time was regarded as a hero, and then sort of afterwards he was kind of shuffled away, and he didn't last long as Prime Minister after the end of the Second World War. But I think just a general concept, what I saw happening or see in that whole scenario is that you're building up the scale of the conflict into a global type of conflict, and you're actually setting things up so that you can manipulate all the governments of the world through one larger group, you know, whatever that group is. I still don't really know what it is. And I think, again, 9/11 was another example of that, where the chess pieces were being moved on a global scale even more, you know, because nobody was really at war on the scale of World War II, at least, when 9/11 happened. Yet it's become a global war on terror, with every country involved, and, you know, and treaties and laws set in Parliament in Westminster in London, at the same time as they were being set in the White House. And I don't think that's ever happened in history before, you know. So that's the way I generally look at it. I don't really sort of study the details that much, because I think a lot of it has been propagandized.
Yeah, part of their problem was that you need a big enemy. And with the fall of the Soviet Union 10 years earlier in 1991, you lost the best of enemies. And over here, the defense budget was eroding. The mission was it being eliminated, and you got to gin up something new. When, you know, it's Islam and the Arab world and all that, you know, terrorism. Oh, help. John, you had a comment.
Yeah, the way we generated is between Gulf War One and Gulf War Two, we launched 5,000 cruise missiles into Iraq because we wanted to create that terrorist. But what I wanted to ask is, who was it that told Hitler where the Lusitania was going to be? Was that Churchill or us?
Well, I don't know that detail, but the Germans had taken out ads that the Lusitania was a subsidized ammo ship. Okay, and then you got your hostages, i.e., passengers on top. And the Germans took out ads in the New York papers saying, don't get on this ship because it's at risk. And then as they neared Ireland that day or night, the commander was replaced by less experienced guys. They slowed down to make it an easy target. And, it wasn't guaranteed that the U-boat would sink it, but that's the way they plotted to make it happen. I don't remember details about, how they
somebody
were tracking the ship.
Off the exact position they were going to be at.
Yeah, I don't know the details on that. But my point about all of this is to put 9/11 in a historical context and get more people to take it seriously. And the whole thing, if it falls apart factually, it's still an Arab blood libel. It's amazing. I thought by now, guys, here we are nearly 13 years after the event, that more people would see through how thin this all was. And as a pretext of war, it should have faded away. And war on the Muslim world is just, compared to the plausibility of the Soviet Union as a big monster, it just pales in comparison. I'm surprised. What about you, Andrew?
Well, one of the things that's continually surprised me, several times I've been sort of in contact with people who are from the Islamic faith, and for example, in 2007, I was invited to go to Birmingham Central Mosque, which is a large Islamic community that goes and frequents that building, and I would have thought there would have been a louder voice from the Muslim community to, you know, sort of be skeptical about 9/11, because they're one of the targets that has been, ideologically, targeted for their religion. And then, of course, you, on the flip side of that, you have this whole political correctness movement where you're not allowed to criticize people's beliefs and so on. Yet, what they've done with 9/11 after that is they've just topped it up with these various incidents, like 7/7 and the shoe bombing, and there's been several incidents like that since, and that's managed to keep the propaganda flow the level that they've needed to keep it, because the population is sufficiently dumbed down that they just need to top it up occasionally, and people will buy into it sufficiently. And I think that's the way that's the reason why we still haven't got a really significant visible skepticism of the 9/11 story all this time later.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful point, Andrew, because one of the articles I clipped out here reads, with a let's roll 9/11 ship ready to sail, Dateline Philadelphia. And we've got the first sentence, a new U.S. Navy ship named to honor 40 passengers and crew members killed when their hijacked United Airlines flight crashed as they fought with terrorists during the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, was put into service Saturday in Philadelphia. It's called the USS Somerset, named for that county And I want to take that event into some depth in terms of our conversation. And listen to what Senator Pat Toomey, Republican of Pennsylvania, says. Quote, "What we commemorate is not that war or an attack on America. We commemorate the day America began to fight back," unquote. So, I mean, it's just, and then in New York City, we have Al-Qaeda suspect faces jury pool. They have Osama bin Laden's son-in-law on trial in New York City. And actually, I don't know what the charges are. He was supposedly Al-Qaeda spokesman after the September 2001 terrorist attack. So they've got some kind of charge, I don't know, what, some kind of legal. But he's not even being accused of participating in September 11th. So, yeah, these stories keep on coming.
And I think also, you know, you've got folks, you know, like Steve Nee Jones, and if he had his way, we'd have Osama bin Thermite, you know, would be the villain.
Osama Nano Thermite.
Yeah. And the micro.
John
and the
Winger, your thoughts?
Yes. Yes.
You just say amen to that little conversation bit. Let's I wanted to go to all four events, but the more I looked at this today, I say we may only get through the first two I wanted to talk to you about. And the first one is the Pentagon event. And John Lear knows a lot about this. The first thing that comes to mind, John, that I would like you to comment on is that supposedly American Airlines Flight 77 with Barbara Olson for one aboard, and then that chick Burlingame, supposedly crashed into that west wall, Ring E of the Pentagon, on the morning of 9/11/2001. And they can't even get the time straight, but it seems to be settling on 9:37 a.m. But now, first problem is that Flight 11 is a phantom flight in terms of the Bureau of Transportation Statistics database. You know, that ACARS, when the plane left the terminal and when it. So what's going on there?
Exactly. And somebody said, John, what is the best, if you only had one thing to prove that no airplanes crashed into the buildings, what would that one thing be? And I would say no vortices. And what that means is when an airplane goes through the air, the wingtips make these huge, powerful vortices. And when you see the smoke and fire on all those buildings, there's none. There's no smoke. There's no vortices twirling those that smoke around. And that stuff that the vortices last for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, and that's why they have to be careful in terms of takeoff, don't they?
That's why they give them 3 minutes spacing.
Yeah, you know, that first came to my attention. It reminds me of Ace Baker was the first one to point that out, to my knowledge, at least. He did something good there. Yeah, it's interesting that you say, hey, that's the most important physical phenom that isn't there, that should be there. Whereas I would say my reaction would be we had the four cleanest crash sites in aviation history. You didn't see the debris that you should. There wasn't one tail section, which tail sections snap off. Typically, right. Because it's all that weight at the end of a long airframe, you know, and those airframes are not all that impressive compared to a steel and concrete building. But Andrew, what's your thought there that first comes to mind with the Pentagon event?
Well, I mean, you know, I haven't studied it as much as you know, the World Trade Center and so on, but because there's less evidence overall. But there are clearly some huge problems with the official story. I mean, that sounds almost ridiculous for me to even say that. But it's still difficult to know exactly what happened, you know, and how the buildings were actually damaged. I certainly began to wonder if this image projection technology, which I think was used at the World Trade Center, was also used at the Pentagon, because I was contacted soon after I started talking about 9/11 by somebody who lives in San Francisco, and they have a friend who works at the Pentagon, and they were quite insistent that they'd seen the plane coming in and coming into the building. They watched it coming in. So you get this anomaly of the damage doesn't add up, and you know that's been discussed at length elsewhere. But yet people said they saw a plane, or some people said they saw a plane, and I don't feel comfortable myself, you know, any of these sites saying that all the witnesses are liars. Maybe Shanksville, that you can sort of, because there weren't many witnesses at Shanksville, but at the Pentagon there were a few witnesses, and at the World Trade Center more. So I think we've got to, you know, I've had people writing to me saying, oh, are you just calling all the witnesses a liar then? Liars, are you? And I said, no, I'm not calling them liars at all. I think it's more complicated than it first appears, and the same is true at the Pentagon.
What I would say we can prove, and that is there was some kind of a large plane, but it was a flyover. The reason I say that is two main pieces of evidence. One is the Citizens Investigation Team, and I don't know if you've seen their video, but yes. They interview all these witnesses, grave diggers in the Arlington Cemetery. And this plane came through there, but it was north of the Citgo station, et cetera, et cetera. It's very powerful evidence. And then second line of evidence developed is that by the pilots for 9/11 Truth, of which John Lear on the line is a founding member and did some of the work, and that what they find is that this plane was too high to hit the Pentagon. It was some 400 feet above the Pentagon. So maybe, John, maybe you could fill us in on a little of that.
Okay, what happened is whoever took the they had to submit the flight data recorder to the FBI, and the FBI had to release it to the public. So what they did is they just filled in the squares to what they wanted to. And one of the squares, there's 156 different parameters that are recorded by those flight data recorders, and one of them is altitude. Well, because the altitude changes with pressure, or the pressure is always changing, what they did is they set the altimeter, which records the altitude for the flight data recorder, to 2992, which is the standard pressure. Then, if there's an accident, they go back and they find out what the real pressure was, in this case 3022, and then tell the exact height of the airplane. But what the FBI didn't know when they did these figures is they didn't know the setting of 2992 for the standard of recording the data, and then that it had to be changed to 302 and corrected. So they just put 100 feet, or the last, or I think 80 feet for the last data point, and thought that would work. But what they didn't know is that it had to be corrected for the standard pressure, and that brings it up to 400 feet, and that means it didn't, you know, it didn't come near the ground.
Hey, I'd like to have Pete Santilli play a couple of those sections I sent in regarding CNN coverage on the morning of 9/11.
Forward to an early
Senator Ted Kennedy in Washington. Chris Plant, a CNN producer, is at the Pentagon, where there is a significant fire. Chris, you're on the phone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Tell me what you know.
Well, arriving at the Pentagon a short time ago, there was a huge plume of smoke which continues to rise from the west side of the Pentagon over in the area where there is a helicopter landing zone. It's along Route 27 if you're looking at maps of the area. The building is currently being evacuated, and police and emergency units are, of course, responding from all around the building and from the local Arlington County Fire Department. The plume of smoke is enormous. It's a couple of hundred yards across at its base. It is billowing into the sky, hundreds of yards. It's impossible for me to say from this side of the building whether the building itself is on fire or up in flames, or exactly what caused this. I did not hear an explosion, but there is certainly a very, very significant fire in this enormous office building on the west front. The building is being evacuated. The Defense Protective Service officers, the police force for the Pentagon, are on a very tight string right now. As I arrived, okay, I was held at gunpoint.
Chris, yes. let me interrupt you for a second. Just hang on. Don't go anywhere. We're getting reports now that the White House is being evacuated.
Okay, Pete, play the next two snippets if you could.
Well, in speaking to people here at the Pentagon as they're being evacuated from the building, I am told by several people that there was, in fact, an explosion. I was told by one witness, an Air Force enlisted, senior enlisted man, that he was outside when it occurred. He said that he saw a helicopter circle the building. He said that it appeared to be a U.S. military helicopter and that it disappeared behind the building where the helicopter landing zone is. Excuse me. And that he then saw a fireball go into the sky. I'm attempting to make my way around to that side of the building in my car right now to see if I can get a better visual perspective on the scene on that side of the building. But I can tell you that security has certainly clamped down. The U.S. Park Police, another federal law enforcement department, has arrived in force on the scene. There is a Park Police helicopter overhead. Every car that arrived at the gate where I was located was being stopped by officers at gunpoint. Everyone is being forced out of their vehicles as they arrive at the Pentagon. It's a very tense situation, obviously, but initial reports from witnesses indicate that there was, in fact, a helicopter circling the building. Contrary to what the AP reported, according to the witnesses I've spoken to anyway, and that this helicopter disappeared behind the building and that there was then an explosion. That's about all I have from here.
Okay, let's do this, Chris.
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon.
I've got to add one more eyewitness account and then ask for comments from my guests, John Lair and Andrew Johnson. And that is my present wife. I didn't know her at the time, but she was a hospice team manager in Northern Virginia in Arlington. And one of her nurses was out making a call on a terminal patient. She was right near the Pentagon. And all into my wife, and she says, "They're bombing the Pentagon. They're bombing the Pentagon." And my wife made some kind of response about, "No, that I don't think that's it. I think they ran an airliner in there or something." But she poo-pooed it or gave some kind of official response. And now my wife says, "The nurse was right. They were bombing me somehow." Okay, you're listening to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm my guests are going to straighten me out on this Pentagon situation on 9/11 here after the break. So you all return. I hate to blow. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you would like to call in and speak with Andrew Johnson and John Lair, the number 218-862-9829. And we do welcome callers at the Guerrilla Media Network. And my guests today are John Lair and Andrew Johnson. And we are discussing the 9/11 Pentagon event. And the evidence shows that no plane crashed at the Pentagon. And let me turn to Andrew Johnson from the UK to get his response. The last witness there was Jamie McIntyre, the with his famous observation, and all those clips were from CNN. So Andrew, what's your thought?
Yeah, well, it just verifies, you know, the other things we've been saying, really, and I think it shows you the power of you know, that you can have over people when something so obvious that Jamie McIntyre says, you know, he can't see any trace of a plane, he can then go back on that, you know, months or years later. It's very telling that, you know, he can be affected in that way. I mean, I haven't heard the other two clips that you played, so those are both very interesting to me, that they also reported just a you know, a fireball or an explosion. So absolutely, we can see just from that the plane stories are extremely suspect.
John, I can hear you're back, aren't you, John Lear?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on those CNN eyewitness clips?
In addition to that, we have April Glaspie, whose desk was 40 feet from the hole, and she said that when the explosion went off, she grabbed her 6-month-old son, who was in his car seat below her desk, and crawled to that hole. And she didn't smell any kerosene, no gasoline, no kind of propellant from any kind of drone or rocket or anything else. And she went out on the grass there and went for triage. And Army Intelligence came over and started grilling her and asked what she saw. And she told them, and they said, no, that's not what you saw. You saw an airplane come through there. But we have two 767s and two 757s with a combined total of 8.6 million parts. Now, by parts, I mean FAA-approved manufactured parts, and they have to be stamped, approved. They go through a lengthy process. This is not something where if they need a bolt, they run down to Home Depot or something and get a bolt. These things have to be approved. They go through a lengthy process, and they're all stamped. So I've never heard of one single part in the 8.6 million that should be there. None was found to have any belong to any of those airplanes. Now, how can that happen? That can happen because there were no airplanes.
Crash investigation of any serious form, never identifying a single part by unique serial numbers, is rather odd, shall we say? And it's the absence of parts. You know what, Veronica Chapman? She's so clever. She said, well, the reason that they're plane huggers is they have so few parts to hug. Now, you know, this whole business, you're pointing, one of the problems with the official story, of course, is that the hole was so small. It was only like a 15-foot diameter thing, and we didn't even see big wing marks. A few minutes earlier at the World Trade Center, that planes disappear in the buildings and leave wing marks behind, even though those undersized. But that leads me to the Thierry Masson, arguably, was the first prominent no-planer. Remember, we had the Hunt the Boeing site? You know, mm-hmm. Where's the Boeing? Yeah. And where's the hole that could swallow this Boeing, that the silhouette of passage? And then he came out with a couple of books about the great imposture, the big 9/11 lie, and it only focused on the Pentagon. But that, in a way, we're off and running then on this no plane crash theme. Andrew, your comment?
Yeah, I think that the immediate comment that came to my mind when you were talking about Thierry Masson was I met him in 2005 when he came to London. And, you know, he was obviously very passionate about what he was saying then. But something must have happened because he hasn't, like so many of the other researchers, he hasn't taken things to the logical conclusion. Or at least if he has, he's certainly not said anything publicly about it. And I always find that quite peculiar. You know, and we were talking a little bit earlier about the idea of some kind of globalist government or something like that, or at least perhaps I brought that up. And it was even David Ray Griffin. I have a video of him linked on my website where David Ray Griffin is advocating a kind of global government. And yet he was the person that came out with the new Pearl Harbor book and managed to get all his books that were criticizing the Bush government into Barnes & Noble, you know, across and other bookstores across the world. So something very strange going on behind all of this, where we're getting multiple levels of propagandizing of this issue.
On that theme, Andrew, there's a very good book by Elias Davidson that came out, I don't know, within the last year. And let me just check the year, 2013. And it's called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence. And the best thing he does, well, he does two great things. The first of them was online, which is proving that the government has no proof, no valid evidence that there were hijackers, Arab hijackers. And I was well aware of that. But the second thing he does is take apart all of these alleged calls from the aircraft.
Yeah.
He does an extremely thorough job. And the upshot of his work is really that there were no planes and no hijackers, but he never mentions Gerard Holmgren's work or Rosalie Gold's work, the Web Fairy, or mine. And I'm not being egotistical, but I'm saying he avoids that. And
he
furthermore,
does.
Yeah, he does. And on page one in his preface, he says in part, the narrative presented everywhere in the media was so overwhelming as to mask from our minds even what our own eyes were seeing. For instance, giant steel skyscrapers collapsing at free fall speed in the time it takes a telephone to ring twice. Now, what is wrong with that? He starts out, this is very Judy Wood-like now, isn't it? We should see what our own eyes are seeing, but he never in this book makes any reference to Dr. Judy Wood's evidence either. So you really wonder, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the truth, or are you on the side of the deceivers?
Yeah.
Hey, John, what's your, you got any comment on that?
No, not on that, but, one of the, there are just so many, important points that debunk the fact that there was airplanes. It could just go on forever and ever. Getting the crew members out of their seats. What are they? This little hijacker is going to get these two great big crew members out of their seats with their belts on and their harness and everything else. It doesn't make any sense. Where are they going to put them in the companionway? It's very, very small. And then the fact that these pilots who have never been in this airplane before are going to navigate to Manhattan. Now, how are they going to do that? This is their first time looking out of the airplane at 30,000 feet. What are they going to see? I mean, it's not like it's a couple of miles away. In some cases, it was 90 miles away. So how are they going to find Manhattan? And, of course, in addition to this, the overspeed warning horn, supposedly, if they were ever going to overspeed, go more than 360 knots indicated, the warning horn was going to go off. And that thing is loud, and it's irritating, and it's built loud and irritating so that the pilot will pull the throttles back. So, a newcomer pilot, how's he going to overcome that? How's he going to overcome that warning horn? And the first time he's flying this airplane, precisely descend and hit a target that's 208 feet wide dead center. It can't happen.
Hey, John, I have two questions that are a pilot technical type questions. First is, some people have asserted that a pilot could simply roll the plane and put these guys on the ceiling, which is now the floor. Would you ever do that with a lumbering type airliner?
Sure. it's stressed for minus 1G and plus 2.5Gs. So to do a half roll and put them on the ceiling isn't exceeding anything in the airplane. That's no big deal. I'm sure I've talked about it with other pilots, and yeah, it could be done.
Okay. The other technical question is, this aircraft, this imagined or real aircraft, was supposedly exceeding 500 miles an hour when it allegedly hit the Pentagon at about a 45 degree angle on the first floor. So some people have pointed out that this is an impossible physics project because of what I'll call the compressed air effect. In other words, you are going so fast, you can't land it at that speed. You can land it at 160, 180 type conventional miles per hour. What about that issue?
Yeah, ground effect comes in at one half the
wingspan.
Span of the wing. So the span of the wing is 150 feet, I think. And so that would be 75 feet would be where you would hit that cushion of air. And that's substantial. The faster you're going, the more that cushion's going to be. So if you aren't ready for it at the exact instant that you need it, you're gonna overfly that thing for sure. There's just no possibility you could hit the first floor.
Okay, I want to Andrew, do you have any? I want to leave the Pentagon for now, if it's okay with you guys. Unless Andrew, you have any more comment you want to add?
Well, I was just, you know, general thing really is, I mean, when we've got somebody like John saying all these things, you know, who's a very experienced and record holding pilot. You know, it just makes me wonder why more people aren't taking notice. You know, it's kind of very frustrating, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, it's very frustrating to me that pilots for 9/11 Truth don't remember their Mr. Rob Moll never answered in the station. I'll then to the 93 at Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The alleged crash there. And the format I'm going to use to do the interview, let me read this little thing, notes I've got. On August 22, 2012, about a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity to visit the Flight 93 Memorial near Lambertsville, Pennsylvania. That's the nearest town, actually. The site is a National Park Service, U.S. Department of the Interior project, and the parking lot was filled with vehicles with license plates from all over the country, maybe a couple from Canada. And I took notes during my visit, and then I returned to our RV campsite in Romney, West Virginia. And I'm going to read a series of quotes, mostly from the signboards I saw. It was a pretty underdeveloped type site, but, you know, it was like the beginnings of the big deal. So the first sign as I entered the memorial said, quote, "A common field one day, a field of honor forever." The signboard continued, "Those who rush to the scene look on in disbelief at charred trees and a smoldering crater." They looked, I found that ironic, you guys. They looked on in disbelief. I would too. You're telling me that a Boeing 757, you know, United Flight 93 crashed here? I mean, if I were there, I'd say, where is it? And that's what so many observers who were there, they wouldn't let the media near it. Man, let me go on. The signboards. So really, this is like the reading the official story on signboards at this memorial site. The signboard continued. It said, "It hints at its mining past, a lasting testament to the deeds of 40 extraordinary people." Now, of course, they made a movie, UA Flight 93, out of this fiction, too.
Mm.
This is like, Andrew, your remark about how this story is constantly reinforced, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
The second sign as we drove along the access road was headlined, quote, a common field, unquote. And it mentioned the coal mining. And then in the mid-1990s, the surface mining of these lands ends. And remember, they did a landfill on this former strip mining site. Then the sign on number two asserted that during quote, their struggle with terrorists, the airplane crashes just 2 miles ahead and not at the terrorists' intended target in Washington, D.C. And my question is, how do they know what the intended target would have been? You know, even if there had been this Flight 93 under command of terrorists, it's like an urban legend. It's just assertions without
right.
Jump in any time, guys. Now, here's an observation I would make about this site. The land was much higher than I expected, and there were impressive views of the surrounding countryside. Then the actual site of the claimed airplane crash was incredibly remote, gentlemen. You couldn't find a better concealed location in the area. Now, of course, there were no eyewitnesses of, this is convenient, there were no eyewitnesses of the alleged crash. It was a very concealed highland with this woods as a border. It was really secret. Very nice.
Wasn't it owned by the Department of Defense, some of that land, or where it crashed?
I've heard they had that famous congressman, what was he, he's an Irishman who subsequently passed away like in 2005. He was a real big pork barrel guy, I think, a Democrat. And there's a lot of defense stuff in the area. Mm. And I forget who owns that land at the time. I don't think that mining company might have still owned it, but I don't think the Department of Defense did. We'd have to find that out. Killtown.com, by the way, probably has the most evidence and videos and pictures and discussion of the Shanksville site and event. Isn't that your impression, Andrew and John? That's mine.
Yeah, I
think so. And that one thing I don't hear brought up too often is that the Shanksville airplane was supposed to crash into building number 7. And that's why building number 7 was ready to be imploded, is because they were going to fake that. But whatever went wrong, whether it was the hologram machine or whether it was video fakery, whatever it was, they couldn't do the same thing they did with World Trade Center 1 and 2 with World Trade Center 7. So what they had to do is they had between 11 o'clock in the morning, when that the Shanksville airplane was going to crash into building number 7, until 5 o'clock when they brought the press in, they had those 6 hours to prepare a site that would be believable. That's why it was so little parts. And actually, you saw one or two parts, and you saw, you know, 5 or 6 guys standing around in hazmat suits. And but they only had 6 hours to prepare for this. So.
But John, they wouldn't run a real plane into the building because it wouldn't have the physical effects they're looking for. And plus, you'd be in big trouble because not everybody would be trustworthy. You'd find there aren't any Arab hijackers. You'd find all kinds of things you wouldn't be supposed to find.
They weren't gonna send an airplane into the building.
No, they are. They weren't. No. And besides, in addition,
it wasn't going to crash at Shanksville either. It was going to either make a low pass like that or whatever, and then disappear like the others did. But whatever.
Now, with the two United planes, this is United 93 and United 175. They were in the BTS database, so officially they did take off. That's in contrast to the two American Airlines planes. then, so, you know, you can't say, oh, they weren't real flights. Now, the pilots for 9/11 Truth, I need to get your input on this, John. And you might have been involved in some of their work, but they find through these ACARs, you correct me if I'm wrong, but they have a messaging service specific to these commercial aircraft. And what those messages show is that whatever this plane was, we'll call it Flight 175, was well west in Pittsburgh, well beyond Philly, when it allegedly hit the South Tower. And the same thing is true of Flight 93, that it's the messaging evidence shows it was in Illinois. So tell us about that.
Well, here we have a case of more amateurs dealing with this thing. You know, they tried to put it together without that many people being involved. But there's things like the altitude, the difference between the altimeter setting of 3022 and the normal setting of 2992. They didn't know about that. And also they didn't know that the ACARS keeps going on the airplane, whether or not there's power to it. And that ACARS was transmitting position 45 minutes to an hour after it was supposed to crash. So it was these little details that tripped him up. And I don't know who was the consultant on this. If it was Chick Burlingame, then that's the usual Navy screw up. That they didn't.
Wait a minute. Hey, I thought those naval aviators were the best, John, because they can land on a postage stamp in the ocean in weather. Not true, huh? Oh, man. But, hey, John, just to confirm, and I haven't looked at that work, but I was impressed at the time by Pilots for 9/11 Truth. In other words, they've got the real ACARS message, and they're going on well after both of these United aircraft were supposed to have crashed, and they're well west of their alleged crash sites. Is that true, John?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's the truth, and that's the bona fide deal.
That's powerful. Yeah. Okay. Now let's go back to my little tour of the Shanksville Memorial site. The third I encountered, it refers to the village of Lambertsville, and it asserts, quote, Flight 93 streaked overhead at more than 500 miles an hour, unquote. And here I assume they're talking about a low altitude easily visible by eyewitnesses. So what about, this relates to the World Trade Center too, what about flying at 500 miles an hour near sea level, John?
Yeah, they had some real poor people helping them figure this out. And like I say, if they had Chick Burlingame, then they had a Navy guy. And of course, they don't know what's going on half the time. And certainly to plan a thing like this, they would have to know the details. And they go around telling everybody they fly 500 miles an hour. They get, you know, all the time, they get to believing it. They don't realize what the limitations are on some of the airplanes.
You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal, and we are interviewing John Lear and Andrew Johnson and discussing the planes on 9/11, all that issue, the fake planes. Okay, come on back after the break. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and if you would like to call in, we do welcome callers here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number, 218-862-9829. My guests today are Andrew Johnson from the UK and John Lear from Las Vegas, the famous retired airline pilot. And we were visiting here at Shanksville, and we only have a half hour left, and it's very clear we're not going to get to do justice to the whole World Trade Center, those two events that are alleged 767 airplane crashes in the Twin Towers. So I propose inviting these two gentlemen back, and we'll spend the entire time on the World Trade Center. we'll get that together later. Would you both like to come back and discuss the World Trade Center plane events?
Sure.
That's me, but let me ask you, what do you think Burlingame is doing today?
What, sipping Mai Tais on a Polynesian island or deceased?
Yeah, he must. He's not deceased, but he's sipping Mai Tais somewhere. Another identity. I'm sure it's, what's his name? What was that vice president's name?
Dick Cheney?
What, Dick vice- Cheney? I'm sure Dick Cheney is taking care of him. I'm sure that Burlingame was his boy. But now, what was the deal on Wendy? Why? How does that fit in?
Wendy
was his daughter that was murdered in New York.
Oh, Wendy Burlingame. Yeah, well, tell our listeners about that suspicious event.
Well, I haven't reviewed that for a long time, but she was murdered shortly after that. And I say murdered. It was a very suspicious circumstances under which she was deceased. And so, you know, I always thought that Burlingame may have called her or tipped her off at something, and they realized that they could have no leaks, whether it's Burlingame's daughter or not, so they just bid her in.
Yeah, so that's speculative, but it's a, you know, a possibility. I noticed here in the seating chart in Elias Davidson's book that Chick Burlingame was supposedly in seat 20E on the flight 77 American Airlines, and I'm going, I thought the official story was he was the pilot. So maybe that was a son, Chick Burlingame the III. I don't know what's going on there. But you, John,
so they put it in the passenger seat, but actually he was flying it.
Yeah, what you suspect is Chick Burlingame flew this flyover plane where they coordinated some kind of explosion or directed energy. I don't know, but they did damage simultaneous with the flyover. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it wasn't direct energy. It wasn't powerful enough for that. But yeah, he did the overfly and then either landed at Andrews, which is just a couple miles down the road, or another airport. You know, they've brought holographic airports into such use where they're totally hidden. You can't see them at all. You fly over and it just looks like regular fields or whatever. So it's very easy to hide airports these days, and they might have taken it to one of those airports. Who knows?
Yeah.
Andrews is a good possibility, though, because he might have just stayed at 400 feet and probably only, 10 miles to Andrews.
Yeah, that's about 10 miles, I'd say, within 10 miles. Yeah, you know, when you talk about hidden airports, it reminds me of Mena, Arkansas, out here in western Arkansas. You can ride by that thing and not even notice it's there. And that's where, you know, Bill Clinton and Barry Seal and company, you know, did the drug smuggling from Central America, et cetera. That's another story. Let me go back to Shanksville and, yeah, Andrew?
Well, I mean, I don't really think I've got much to add. I mean, the Shanksville, the things that I'm familiar with is the story of the pathologist who I think was called, or the coroner, Wally Miller.
His name was Wallace Miller.
Miller, yeah. And he, you know, was another person that seemed to sort of come out with one story first, and then later retracted that story and seemed to have been harassed. And so he pointed out that there weren't actually any bodies for him to, you know, investigate and write reports about. So that's another factor which suggests that at Shanksville there was indeed no passenger plane crash of any kind.
I remember, yes, he said that it was as if the plane stopped and left off all the passengers because there wasn't a drop of blood. And then the whole thing is so ridiculous. The hole is no more than 30 feet by 15 feet. That's being generous.
Yeah.
And that first witness, what was her name? Ava something. She lived in a mobile home nearby, and she said, "This hole is smaller than my house." Yeah, I like all these. You know, I trust a lot of the statements of people out there in rural southwestern Pennsylvania, because you can't bring in Hollywood act or New York City actors or anything. You know, you aren't being put on by these semi-rural people. That's I like that.
Yeah.
Let me give you a little bit more of the official story from these signboards. And it says, this is sign four, a gap is visible where the damaged trees were removed. The FBI excavated the site, and the crater was later filled in at the direction of the coroner. I got a problem with a couple of those. Like, there were charred trees on the fringe of this so-called crash site, but there wasn't a burned grass. There should have been a lot of burned grass, from just as there should have been on the face of these tower walls, because the fuel is going to be all over it and exploding and burning, wouldn't it?
Well, that's assuming an airplane crashed.
That's right. Yeah, the evidence is not consistent with a real airplane crash. Exactly. Right. Yeah, you're one of my brightest students, John. Okay, let's go to sign six. See if we. I also find it ridiculous that the FBI deferred to the coroner on any decisions on the site. That's Wally Miller told was going to make a decision to fill the hole. It's
I see. Maybe because there was so much blood around there.
You know, that's what this. The first weapon in politics is ridicule. Somebody famous once told me. And that's what we're into now. The whole thing is so ludicrous. It's just laughable. Okay, now, sign six said, Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. Oh, the capital letters in the headline was, America attacked. And then they included this Val McClatchy photo of a wispy mushroom cloud in the distance, you know, where the alleged crash occurred. Been widely exposed. But continuing on with the signboard, Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. The terrorists fly two jet airliners into the World Trade Center's Twin Towers in New York City and a third aircraft into the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. The deadliest attack on American soil by any foreign nation or terrorist group. Prove it. Now we take off and go to war in the Muslim world, you know, partly for oil. Energy, it's about energy, is one of the issues. And Dr. Wood is very keen on that as a motive and suppressing infinite energy. And Andrew has some expertise on that issue. The whole Middle East oil reserves and all that?
Well, I mean, you know, I have sort of some circumstantial evidence that one of the people involved with that whole industry was responsible for getting my YouTube channel shut down, which was to do with the very topic of energy. And, you know, he's directly linked into the, you know, some of the stuff that John and I talk about, you know, the UFO stuff. This is Tony Craddock is the person that I'm talking about, who's connected to Dr. Stephen Greer, or has been in the past. You know, so there's a whole line of evidence there which talks to both the cover-up and actually what happened. It's linked to both of those, really. But that's a separate sort of conversation, really.
John has already addressed this, but I'm going to give him this clip from signboard seven. It says, the terrorists on board take over the cockpit. But nobody in officialdom has ever explained how this could possibly happen. And on that issue, what was her name? Condoleezza Rice on Sunday morning talk show television said that they were going to put out a white paper, which is the Brit term for this report to prove up the government case. And as did Secretary of State Powell, but the government never tried to prove any of this, including the critical question of how are you going to take over the aircraft?
Right. And it gives us pilots a bad name because, one, it makes us think that we're going to give up our airplanes without a fight. And the other is that some raghead with no hours in the airplane is able to navigate this thing 90 miles and hit a target 208 feet wide dead center. I mean, what is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, at 580 miles an hour. Yeah, it gives you a bad name because any one of us could, you know, just get the manual and get in the cockpit. And,
you know, $150,000 a year to do this, and now they find out that some guy can just get in there and do it himself.
It's just, I like the way you're handling this, John, because it's cracking me up, and it gives the proper ridicule of the official story and all of its somber. The consequences have been enormous. Who knows how many, a couple million people have died at the hands of the United States of America as a result of this, probably a million in Iraq or more. And then our civil liberties being chipped away, the NSA spying on us, and on and on and on, just enormous, which is why we've got to keep talking about it and researching it.
Yeah.
Okay, sign 8 says, the cockpit voice recorder captures their struggle. Shouts, screams, calls to action, and sounds of breaking glassware. John, where do you get breaking glassware from on an airliner? Do they serve anything in glassware?
Surely. It was in the top of climb. We wouldn't be drinking martinis then. Later. So. Let me think. Breaking glassware. I'm not sure.
That's breaking glassware. I'm going.
Maybe it's one of those cabinets for the to get at the axe. You know what? It says break glass to get the axe.
Oh, yes. There's some glass that maybe they could be referring to. It's interesting. The Elias Davidson book, one of his reasons to doubt the phone calls from aircraft, there are a lot of them, but one of them is almost every passenger is calm. Many of these calls have no shouting or screaming or any notion of violence in the background, while others do. And none of them are really credible, even though many there were calls to relatives. And yeah, that happened, and the FBI sometimes suppressed or distorted these calls. Andrew, have you had a chance or have been motivated to look at Davidson's book? I think it's well worthwhile, but it's of limited orbit.
Do it tonight. What is the name of the book?
Elias Davidson. It's a double S, and he's a Palestinian by birth, but he lives in Germany now. It's called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, subtitle Counterfeiting Evidence. It's Elias Davidson. And you, John, would be especially interested because it deals very well with disproving all of these airplane calls.
Okay.
Maybe you would have some criticisms or find some shortcomings, but you'll recall I called you and asked you about them, and you basically confirmed he was very sharp. He must have read my interview with you, or he's just a sharp guy, on nomoregames.net, because he also mentioned this problem of how do you get these resistant pilots out of their seats and out of the way. It's a mess.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I loved about John in that interview on my website was John says, hey, we won't give up the TV remote, much less the control of the aircraft, right? You know, and it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Okay, let me see now. Oh, Signboard 8 claimed that Flight 93, United, rolls upside down and at 10.03 a.m. plows into an empty field at a speed of 563 miles an hour, unquote. Nice that they know the exact speed. When they didn't have any flight data recorder that I know of. And then the time of the alleged crash is in dispute. You know, supposedly it was 10:10, but it didn't even crash. You know, I mean, there was a plane out there with the eight cars messaging, but it was in Illinois.
Yeah, right.
Oh, now here I got to give you guys. This is an interesting thing. You know, I said in August of 2012, I visited the memorial there, and I went over toward a wall they had constructed to honor, quote, the crew and passengers of Flight 93, unquote. The last name is Honor Elizabeth Wayno of Baltimore, Maryland. And irony, we had at the RV campground, the neighbors next door, that was in Romney, West Virginia, a couple hours drive away, they claimed that before we left on our visit, that Elizabeth or Honor Elizabeth Wayno, they knew her. They she was the bridesmaid at a marriage ceremony for one of their children in Italy. So they looked highly credible. And he was a military guy, ex-military, and. Am I still on there, Pete?
Yeah.
Ex-military?
Sure. You're doing well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was getting a different picture on my screen here. And we were both motorcycle guys, and he actually went from military base to military base teaching motorcycle riding and safety, because a lot of guys get out there and get killed. Over exuberant and inexperienced on a motorcycle. So I didn't want to talk to him about it or debate it. But she's mentioned on about 10 pages in Elias Davidson's book, and she was a real person. You know, sometimes we doubt this. And he examines her calls, and they don't look real either, because for one thing, she doesn't cite any violence. Although she closes her call, she's talking to her stepmother. She called her parents, in effect, and she's talking to her stepmother. And she basically says, oh, I got to go because they're going to take over the cockpit. That was it, you know. They aren't really believable. Have you looked at that, Andrew? A lot of these, of course, some of these cell phone calls turn out to be impossible technically at the time as well.
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Going back to Elias Davidson, I actually met Elias in 2007 because he came and did a few talks in the UK. And so, yeah, I'm quite familiar with some of his research. I haven't seen his latest book, but I've read most of that paper he did about the hijackers, and I think that's a very valuable study, you know, which backs up everything else that we've been talking about this evening. So I think it's very important that people realise there is no evidence that these alleged hijackers ever were able to get on the planes. There's no testimony from any of the ground crew that these people are actually seen getting on any of the planes, which, you know, lends support to the conclusion that the whole story from top to bottom was almost completely made up, you know, and had the support to make it look plausible both in the media and in the, you know, perhaps key people in the military and so forth and in the political establishment. So, you know, but I think it's a real shame when, and there are many examples like Elias, where he will not include references to, you know, the work that you've done, some of the stuff that John Lear has said, and of course, Dr. Judy Wood's research, which I spoke to Elias about at some length, and he seemed to get quite interested at one point, but then he kind of backed away. So when somebody is tackling these topics, which are of great importance and great, you know, very harrowing to look at, you know, when they go so far and they only go 90% of the way and don't go the 100%, it's rather disappointing. You know, you kind of expect a little bit more, really. Well, I do anyway.
Yes, yes. I share your observation there, because he is a very smart guy. And when he digs into whatever limited area he may dig into, like the alleged airplane calls, he does a very thorough job. Mm. And I'll give you one more, at least one more item from the signboards here at the Shanksville Memorial to stimulate your response. Here we have a headline that says, "The Investigation." Oh, well, let's learn about the investigation from the government, the official point of view. Quote, "The September 11 attacks generate the largest investigation in FBI history. Enough remains are recovered to positively identify everyone on board the plane. Evidence recovered includes knives, passports belonging to the terrorists, which you don't even need for domestic flights, and handwritten documents in Arabic describing the terrorists' plans for the attack," unquote. John, does this sound plausible, that they're getting on board with their Arabic plans for the attack?
Well, you know, it's so ridiculous. That's why I wonder, you know, I have good friends, pilots that, you know, I've known for years, excellent pilots, you know, and I've asked them about this, and they just go, huh? You know, I said, well, you know, there was no airplanes crashing the World Trade Center. Huh? You know, they don't even think about it. It worries me. Why are we worrying about these people?
Well, yeah, the morning of, I asked myself, I said, how could aluminum airliners disappear and leave this outline behind? I said, hey, somebody's going to explain that to me, aren't they? I mean, this is like a Tom and Jerry cartoon, right? I mean, yeah. And here we have, now this is this builds on Andrew's disappointment with Elias Davidson. We're disappointed that he's not going that final distance. He's stopping short, you know, at 20 miles in the marathon here. And so many engineers and scientists are either afraid or ignorant or part of the active cover-up, perhaps. So there's all kinds of reasons, excuses, but it's surprising more have not come forward to speak the truth, as my favorite engineer, Dr. Judy Wood, has.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is one of the huge problems, and we get a number of, I mean, like going back to Killtown, who you mentioned earlier on, he's got a great collection of videos, but, you know, he posts a comment on his forum discussing these things, saying that he thinks that, you know, discussion of directed energy weapons being used to destroy the World Trade Center is a distraction from looking at the plane issue, you know. And then he starts to promote the video fakery angle, which, frankly, when you study it, doesn't explain all of the evidence, you know. And again,
right. And your countryman, Rich Hall, has done this fantastic thing on Rich Planet, really, that is very convincing that what we saw was a high-tech light show.
Right.
And that explains so many anomalies that we'll try and do in a month on another show, where we can discuss the planes, the non-planes at the World Trade Center in more detail.
Right.
Let me give you another signboard statement from Shanksville. Excavation of the crater reaches a depth of 40 feet where aircraft debris is no longer found. On September 24, 2001, the FBI closes its field investigation, and the Sunset County coroner later fills the crater and restores the scene to its condition before September 11. Am I hearing some music? I believe we got. Oh, this is Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd.
Welcome to the machine.
Yeah, welcome to the machine. Yeah, this has the appropriate gravitas and doomsday texture to it. You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal, and I want to thank my guests, John Lear and Andrew Johnson, for a very useful, insightful, enjoyable discussion of the plane, no plane issue on 9/11. So come on back next week. We'll change topics, but I hope in a month that we will discuss plane, no plane at the World Trade Center. Thank you for listening.
I'm going to try to see if I can find out where Chick Burlingame is today.
Let's get on the hunt. Thank you, John and Andrew.
Thanks, Morgan. Thanks, John.
Okay. See you, Andrews.